that are basically where the police are writing out the tickets, and that's where it winds up. Now, the laws are going to fall underneath the jurisdiction of that area, and they're going to apply whatever they can in the kitchen sink to try to get whatever tickets they can to stick. That's what I'm saying. A lot of times, talking to the district attorney first and getting in there ahead of time and get them to interpret it the way that, you know, it's, hey, look, this is not a cell phone, this is not a text messaging device, you can get it thrown out. Here again, the problem is, in New York City, I think, Bernie, where the confusion comes in with New York City as opposed to New York State is, you can't take this upstate New York and fight it. You got to go into the city to do it. And the problem is, if you try to fight it on the issue of data, in legal terms, data could be voice. And that's the problem. And to just go inside there with that is, you know, your appeal. Initially, I would feel more comfortable going in there with emergency, because at least it gets you in the door, and then you can argue everything else later. But if they just throw it out before you even get in there again, you don't get a second day. KC2 QIQ.
Bernie, you might have a rebuttal. K2YO, K2RIW.
KD2DWL with comment.
My point is that I'd be going in with a lawyer. I would have some league assistance, and that's basically what Bozak did. Was he took it with lawyers and the whole mess, and that was the critical point of it.
Interesting. KD2DWL, Kilo Delta 2 Delta Whiskey Lima? Question mark. Thought of your name, sir, and your comment or question. K2RIW on the TechNet.
That's correct, Dick. This is Dennis Foley, KD2AOC. This is for Bernie. I have a personal number of Shlomo, I hope Bernie's got a pen, Shlomo Alfasa, who is the public information officer for New York City Arrocks. So he might be the person to contact. Bernie, if you got a pen, let me know, and then I'll give you the number to call.
QSL, ready.
1-8-530-2317. His call sign is Kilo India 4 GG Uniform.
So, let me make sure we got that correct. Phone number 718-530-2317. And I think you said the call letters were Kilo India 4 Golf Uniform, QSL, K2RIW.
That's correct. He might be the person who might be able to, you know, tell you what other hams are experiencing and how they're coming up against it. And that's he's New York City Amateur Radio Emergency Communications Service. He's the PIO.
KQ Yankee Oscar, KQRAW, go ahead, Bernie.
Got that information. I will make it a point this coming week to at least make contact with them. I've had pretty good success at this point of just presenting. It is going to be a confrontational situation, that the police officer is going to state something. You're going to have to tell him that you do not think that that is correct. You're not telling him he's wrong. You're saying that what he's stating may be incorrect, and that you have legal documents which you will present now and when you go to court and on appeal. And that's really the point, is to point out that you're not just going to drop this, that you are going to fight it. Here's the situation. It has been overturned before, and you plan on taking this out to its fullest extent.
To HRO. Yeah, HRO, stand by a second. And that's an important point, not to be confrontational. We're not telling the officer he is wrong. We're implying that the instruction he was given has some error and misinterpretation in this particular situation, and that you have an awful lot of legal backing, and this is not going to be dropped. He's going to be spending quite a bit of time in court due to a misunderstanding. HRO, go right ahead, K2RIW.
2RIW, WB2HRO. We have to emphasize the emergency preparedness aspects of that. because technically, even though it's under a different jurisdiction, when you talk on a radio, amateur radio, to another person, like say in the case we're describing it while driving or whatever, technically you're using your voice to communicate and listening to a person at the other end. It's similar to cell phone communication or any other two-way radio communication as far as this element of distraction. So you can't win on that point. You have to win on the point that it's a different kind of service. In other words, it's emergency preparedness, a license, et cetera. But to say it's not communication, you know, they could get you on that. So there's no inherent difference between talking on an HT or a cell phone. You know what I mean? Or a CB or a...
You're onto something here, Joe, and I'm going to add something to it. WB2HRO in the group, K2RIW. At first, you would say the voice communication of a ham radio contact and the voice communication of a cell phone. They are both voice, and you would think they're similar. They are not. We all have seen a person using a cell phone, which is truly duplex bidirectional. By that, I mean the person is talking and listening simultaneously. He's talking and listening, and he's got an argument going with his wife. She's shouting at him. He's shouting at her. He's waving his hands in the air while he's driving and showing all kinds of anger because of the bidirectional, simultaneous kinds of communication that a cell phone in the ideal world is able to provide. We ham radio operators use pure simplex voice communication for, let me pick a number, 60 seconds at a time. You talk. You're talking exclusively, you're not hearing, you're getting a chance to compose your thoughts, and it's an environment that gives you a hell of a lot less anger. And then you go into the listening mode and lay down the push-to-talk microphone for a period of time, if you know what I mean. So when it comes to the kind of voice-created driving distraction, it is my belief that simplex ham radio is a hell of a lot less able to create the dangerous driving condition compared to a cell phone. So even though they're both voice, in my mind there's a hell of a lot of difference. Wonder if you think I'm onto something on that one, Bernie. K2 Yankee Oscar, K2 RIW in the TechNet.
N1 ALF.
N1 ALF acknowledged. There's a couple of issues regarding that. Number one, cell phone operators are not federally licensed, which is a license that supersedes the state, any state situation. Number two, the ARRL's lawyers, their legal staff, felt that the best way to go after this was to pick apart the law rather than to push the emergency communication part. So I'm going to follow where the lawyers say it's going to work out easiest. So that's kind of what I'm following. One point I do want to make is if you're pulled over and you did something stupid, you were violating the law and using your radio, take the ticket. Don't be a jerk about it. If you're doing 65 in a 50-mile-an-hour zone talking on the radio, take the ticket. You are guilty.
Rich recognized, but before you we have, I think it's Robert, N1 Alpha Lima Foxtrot. Go right ahead. And a beautiful picture of you in uniform there, Robert. N1 ALF, K2RIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
N1 ALF. Thank you, Dick, and everyone on the net there. Last time we talked, Dick was on generator safety. State of Connecticut has dropped that now. State of Connecticut, you cannot get a ticket for operating on a ham radio anymore. They do not classify us under the cell phone bill, which it was actually written in there. And if you look that up in the state of Connecticut, they actually classified us as performing vehicles there in the emergency stuff that we do. So they definitely dropped it. So you might want to check into the state of Connecticut also there. N1 ALF, back to you, Dick.
KD2 DWL with another comment.
DWL recognized, but stand by a second there. Bob comes from Greenwich, Connecticut. Obviously, the state of Connecticut is a lot more progressive in understanding of ham radio. Looks to me like it's going to take a while before New York City
comes up to the 21st century on this particular one. There's a lot of misunderstanding going on. The first one was Rich N2EO, go right ahead, Rich. N2EO, K2LIW in the TechNet.
A couple of years ago now, I was on Northern Boulevard here in Queens, and a woman alongside of me kept veering back and forth, almost hit my car. She didn't hit it, but she almost hit it. I didn't know if she was drunk or diabetic and having, you know, some problem. Anyway, I called 911 on my cell phone, and I told them what was going on, and I said, listen, I don't want to get a cell phone ticket. So the woman, and by the way, the 911 operators are, she was very nice. She said, no, don't worry about it. We're not going to ticket you. She said, just stay on the line with us because, where I saw the car was right past, anybody knows that area, where the 111 precinct is. So they said, we're going to try and intercept the car. And she asked me to stay with her, and she said they're not going to ticket me. So I just wanted to pass that along. And to Rio.
35, Rich. Sound like you had a pleasant encounter in that particular experience. Dennis, KD2 DWL, K2R, give me go right ahead with your further info.
Okay, I'm on the New York State DMV. Somebody had mentioned it before. And clearly, under emergency services, ham radio, you can get a plane. Now, there seems to be a contradiction there. They're giving the people a ticket for using emergency services equipment when they're designated it as an emergency service. The fact that you have your federal license means that wherever you are emergency service, whether you're in your car or you're walking on the street. So I would definitely bring up the fact that, you know, New York State itself, or, yeah, New York State recognizes you as emergency service. So it doesn't matter where you are, you're practicing it.
KC2QIQ with it, further information on that.
You got it, Glenn.
By the way, these are great points that everybody's bringing out, and these were a couple of discussions that that I had with a couple of my friends the last couple of days. Certainly not on air, but you know, people I know that are, you know, practice law inside New York City, and one of the items that they basically said to bring up in this particular case is Part 97. There are parts in Part 97, which is the federal ruling that the guideline of law that covers the amateur radio service. And I believe you can find enough things inside there that point to emergency service communications that if on your appeal you were to, with an attorney, go in there and argue emergency service, it will definitely get you the appeal. And I think if you push it far enough, somebody's going to realize just to drop this one like a hot potato right away, because now that means that they have to argue not that you were using the device, they have to argue now that you're not in emergency service, which means now that they've got to go back and study. That means they got to do work, and it was a $60 ticket that they might lose. KC2QIQ.
The question is, what is the portable device with a stationary device? Should the radio mounted in the car be treated as a portable?
I don't think there's any doubt that the radio in the car is portable. A fixed device usually is at a fixed location, a base station, and very few base stations are on four wheels. I'm having trouble believing there's any doubt on that. And so the electronic device, the portable device, the emergency device, the emergency vehicle, by way of Part 97, which I think is what Federal Register Part 97 that really defines in the U.S. Code what is the section for the Federal Communications Commission, the subsection on ham radio licensing, you would like to believe that that somewhat is preemptive to state law and motor vehicle law. You'd like to believe that. Of course, a person following state law because he's because he's a judge in one of the five boroughs of New York City, from his point of view, his set of laws dominate, and what the federal government does, the outside world from his point of view, and to some degree he's going to not emphasize it, not recognize it.
Did I make an argument to that one?
Those were a bunch of opinions, and I may be dead wrong. Go ahead, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
Yeah, see, that's not how the law works. See, this is the funny part. Everybody thinks that the law is very reasonable and that everything is written. It's written words, and that's how everything goes by. And when an appeal is written and an attorney signs the bottom and it goes before a court, the judge doesn't, I mean, they may look at it to see if it, in other words, then what they're going to do is they're going to review the law. And they're going to look at it, and they're going to say, oh, look, emergency is an objection. Oh, okay, was emergency discussed in the first part? Oh, no, it wasn't. Okay, now you get an appeal. You go to step two. Step two is now the district attorney, not the judge, or somebody from the district attorney's office has got to look at it now and say, oh, it was an emergency. And now they've got to argue back with your attorney in front of the judge, and then the judge has to make the decision. See, that's where it gets sticky, and do they really want to push it that far? You see what I'm saying? So it's a push back and forth, and the judge is just the moderator in the end, who just says, you know, who can do what and argue what. KC2QIQ.
So getting back to Bernie's original appeal, first of all, looks like my question has been asked. I heard Bernie earlier in the day talk about the Bozak decision. And my first question to Bernie was, where do I go to get a copy of that? Now I know. You go to limarc.org, and you go to those blue sections down below, and you'll eventually open up one of those bars, and you'll find the Bozak decision, which ultimately was favorable to ham radio. That's the good news. If I understand correctly, it was an upstate traffic court that made that favorable decision on appeal, I would guess. And whether or not you can use that to get a favorable decision in the five boroughs of New York City is a little bit worrisome to me. But federal preemptive law, I'd like to believe, particularly with Glenn's suggestion of going first to a district attorney before going before the judge and getting a definition of how federal law or oversees or overpowers to some degree the laws that are being used for motor vehicles in the five boroughs of New York City. I'd like to believe that that's going to help. Anyone with any further questions, decisions, suggestions, or whatever for Bernie, K2 Mike Uniform, Monkey's uncle, he's the guy who asked the original question, who is about to go to appeal because he did have a $60 fine, unfavorable decision at his first hearing at the traffic court. Anyone with any further information on this, give me your call letters right now. K2LIW on the TechNet.
K2ATG.
Okay, I heard N2ATG. Go right ahead, Dave.
Yeah, hi, Dick, N2ATG. Just a couple of quick comments. Glenn has come up with some very interesting, comments. Good stuff, good way of thinking. I just wanted to make a quick comment about the emergency service aspect. One of the fellows that signed into the net earlier made a statement that, because we're, as hands, we're members of an emergency service, something to the effect that, that makes your car an emergency vehicle. No, that's not the case. The DMV does recognize hams as an emergency service. They allow us to have those neat ham plates, and that's under emergency services. But that does not make your vehicle an emergency vehicle. That's all spelled out in the DMV, which vehicles are considered emergency vehicles. And obviously, an emergency vehicle with, red lights, sirens, that kind of stuff.
And what Dave is saying probably is quite significant. Dave, you did spend a significant portion of your life as a driver of an emergency vehicle. So I think you're saying that the vehicle itself, the thing that's on the four wheels, is fairly clearly defined as to whether or not it is or is not an emergency vehicle. It may contain emergency capable communicating electronics on board, and the ham radio operator is providing an emergency communication service. But you're saying, if I understand you correctly, Dave, you're saying don't push the idea that the vehicle is an emergency vehicle. You'll probably lose that one, is what I think you're saying, Dave. And 2APG for clarity, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, that's it, Dick. Yeah, like I say, while we are the ham plates, if you get ham plates, that plate, if you look at it in the DMV, that plate identifies you as a member of an emergency service, quote unquote. However, to stretch that and to say that I'm driving an emergency vehicle, now you're in trouble. Just to make it an analogy, it's almost like saying that a cop drives his police car all day long, but when he gets relieved and he gets in his Volkswagen to go home, now he's driving an emergency vehicle in his private car. Obviously, he's not.
Yeah, that does make some sense. Wes, on two or three occasions now tonight, you've asked the question about 2, 3, 4, and 10 attorneys. I'm having trouble understanding what you're asking. And I know darn well that Bernie, K2 Mike Uniform, does not have the financial resources of hiring a large number of attorneys. So I'm not quite sure what you're trying to say on that one, Wes. And 2XJN, K2RIW.
I understand that. No, it's, if the person could request to represent himself and either as his own attorney at the same token, the person could assign 10 attorneys, 20 attorneys, or 100 attorneys, or could assign people acting as an attorney. That's the question to Bernie, if that's legally possible, because it's not that he should afford or who could afford that. It could be the Russian way. And the Russian way is the club has 400 whatever members, and apart from there are plenty of other clubs. And the Russian is show up in front of City Hall and bring the media. This club has people of all of the professions. What's the big deal? Give it to the media. As answering to your question, if this is the state law or New York law, the 1225D states about use of portable electronic devices in New York. That's where I get that from. And that's it.
Yeah. To create a media event where you hope to get a local newspaper to send or a reporter, a photographer to take pictures of a large number of, let's say, LIMOC members to appear in that court and show a lot of force. It's a possible approach. I'm a little bit afraid the judge will say, hey, this is not a popularity contest. That's not relevant. And these people, if they're not attorneys, they're not going to be allowed to testify. The judge might say that. A person who wants to represent himself quite often has said that, yes, you can be your own attorney, but you have a fool as a client. Very few of us are really able to present the credentials that would a judge would recognize you as an attorney, as a person who is qualified to speak about law and interpretation of it. So if Bernie wants to guarantee success at the next level, I know the answer would be that he choosing the correct attorney would drastically increase his level of potential success. Now, whether or not he's willing to put up the finances to do that, that's another whole decision. I'm a little bit worried that the appeal case, if it's not done very carefully, and maybe speaking to a district attorney first, I'm a little bit afraid that the appeal case could easily be lost because a prior judgment has already been made that was negative to what he desires. To get the law changed is not going to be so easy in New York City. I'm a little bit afraid that New York City is like, let me drop.
Dick, how about the professionals in a subject? How about the witnesses? Does he have a right to all of this? The police officer that you mentioned would be the one who would be an expert in it. And guys, it's a comic. That's what you're talking about. In Europe, it's quite a different way.
I'm reasonably sure that if there was a difference of opinion between the arresting officer, the officer who issued the citation, and you acting as your own attorney, I think 90-some-odd% of the time the judge is going to listen to the police officer as an expert in law, and you as a non-lawyer will not be respected in that area. I'm afraid that that's the way it's likely to turn out. You represent yourself, be your own attorney. You have a very small fraction of the amount of respect in that court, in my opinion. So if Bernie wants to guarantee success, he's going to need the proper attorney, in my opinion, particularly where he wants a favorable judgment so that he can begin the process of reversing this crazy wording of this electronic device definition being used in the New York City area, if I understand correctly. Not an easy one. And with any further comments or suggestions for Bernie, give me your call letters right now, K2RIW and the TechNet.
And to SLW, John, with a comment.
Go right ahead, John, SLW.
Okay, I was looking on the internet quickly. I found a website, nytrafficticket.com. The law is printed there. The law was original around 2009 and was revised. The law states specifically portable electronic devices. Let me let it drop. Would assume that an electronic device like a radio or communications unit or GPS unit that's built into the car would not be subject to the fine. So that's something for Bernie to look at. He can go there, he can type in the texting while driving law and get a copy of the law and read the law. And there are many articles there on that website.
That was a good one.
Sean, would you suggest
what is not the portable device? Have mounted in the car, including this big screen with your GPS, whatever you have there, is not a portable device. And the radio, two-way radio, is not a portable device if it's built into the car.
Yeah, John, give me your interpretation now. You just went to nytrafficticket.com, and do you believe that proper interpretation of what is written there would essentially force a favorable decision for Bernie, K2 and Michael's uncle, Monkey's uncle? Is that your interpretation, John? N2SLW, K2RIW and the TechNet?
Oh, from the way I read it and from the way the law is worded, if you're holding a portable device in such a way that it's conspicuous, you're liable to a summons. Initially, the law was written that you had to commit another violation at the same time before they could write the summons for the portable device. The law was subsequently changed that if you conspicuously handle a portable device, electronic device, while driving, you're eligible for a ticket under that section of that law.
Now, hold on now. I got a real question for you on this one. Let me drop. If I'm holding the coil cord microphone, push the talk button, and I'm holding that microphone against my mouth, and that in turn is going to either a chunk of electronics sitting on the seat or a chunk of electronics that's mounted into the dashboard. Still, that microphone with the push-to-talk button is a conspicuous portion of an electronic device. So just holding the microphone in front of my face, do you believe that could create the situation where you would get a ticket? N2SLW, KQLIW. Go ahead, John.
N1ALS for our next comment.
ALS and the wings. John, first, go ahead.
Hey, Dick, you're asking me to interpret the law. The law says a portable electronic device. If the microphone's attached to something that's attached to the car and you're handling it, I don't see how they could consider it portable. However, maybe we should all look into hands-free operation. That way there would be nothing conspicuous. Back to you.
Well, in the state of California, while entering Edwards Air Force Base, I had the earphone, one side of a set of earphones on my head, because that gave me better communication when plugged into my IC2AT handy-talkie. And I got pulled over by California Highway Patrol. He let me go because I convinced him that only one ear was covered. But in California, your ears being covered by a so-called hands-free device does not, from their point of view, that's interfering with your ability to hear a horn honking or whatever. So there are places where even that wouldn't do so well. Let's see what Bob should say on all this. N1ALF, K2RIW. Do you think holding the microphone is a conspicuous electronic device in New York City? What do you think, Bob? N1ALF, K2RIW?
N1ALF. Well, the way the laws is in New York are written is basically the same way it was in Connecticut. It's a portable hand device. It's not a fixed device that was actually came from the factory which your car was installed in, like the GPS unit on your dashboard or whatever. That's the way it's state of Connecticut. Fortunately, we had some politicians that we had in our pockets there that helped. And what they showed, the proof of the amount of accidents that were caused by ham radio operators operating on a radio, on a microphone, and the amount of tickets that were given out, and I think it was like, I mean, if they were going to make $10,000 revenue on it, it just didn't fly. Let me drop it for a minute. So it wasn't worth, and they showed how ham radio operators provide an emergency service there. So that's how we end up passing that bill there. So that got passed. As a firefighter there, if I'm in route, I can talk on the phone, I can talk on the radio. I'm exempt from that. But I know New York State. I lived in New York State for many years, and New York State has a law for a law and a tax for a tax, and New York State is different from the five boroughs there. So basically, what all you guys are going to have to do in New York is get a politician in your pocket there and show the proof of the emergency use of ham radio operators, and I suggest everyone carry their license. N1ALF, over to you, Dick.
Hey, I believe it goes to the suggestion there, Bob. It looks like carrying a copy of the Steve Bozak decision might help a little bit. Carrying a copy of your license is certainly going to help, your ham radio license. Carrying some kind of a one-page, one-and-a-half-paragraph document from the ARRL describing what is a ham radio operator. We have to accept the fact that we're the oddball. There's only one of us per 500 in the general population. And a significant number of those people out there, including law enforcement officers, don't really know what a ham radio operator is if they haven't met one. And so it ain't easy. Anyone with any further suggestions or comments, give me your call letters right now. K2RIW and the TechNet.
N2SLW again.
SLW? SLW, go right ahead.
You listen to Limark around rush hour, and you hear guys on the radio, if any of them approach a vehicle that they identify as official, they immediately become less conspicuous.
Oh, I have heard that on many occasions, and that's a beautiful thought. That's one possible suggestion. Don't push it. In other words, in order to be a safe driver, your eyes are continuously moving. You're looking forward, left mirror, right mirror, rear view mirror, and back to the road. You need situation awareness. You're keeping track of almost every other vehicle, including what might be a law enforcement vehicle. And by some magic, you're going to make a guess that maybe it's a plainclothes law enforcement vehicle because the person inside is wearing a uniform. So, yeah, it looks to me like the smartest thing to do is drop the microphone, explain later to your buddies why you're not talking when you see any of the above, because you don't want to push your luck because it's too easily be misinterpreted, and you end up spending time in court and your money and getting points against your license, and then you have to go through a battle to try to reverse it all. That's a good suggestion. And so if we're doing enough situation awareness, I'd like to believe 90% of the time that's an extremely good defense. And with any further questions or comments, give me your call letters, K2RIW and the TechNet.
K2QIQ.
Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, I kind of know that this is the topic of the hour, and I think a lot of people here are getting also very, very paranoid about a lot of this, probably a lot more than need be. And I think, you know, one of the things that has to be mentioned here, too, is, you know, I think most of us, you know of police officers, have worked with them, and you know, most of them are quite reasonable. I mean, it's pretty rare that you don't find reasonable police officers out there, and I think a lot of it is really driving skill. I mean, when you're out on the road and you're driving, and I mean, most of us realize this while you're driving along, you look around, and everybody out there is driving insane. And here we are, we're just going by with our little mobile radios. And I think 90% of the time, if your driving skill is good, and, you know, you're paying attention to your driving and everything else, you're a needle in a haystack. I mean, compared to everybody else, cutting everybody else off and jamming on their brakes and making crazy turns and everything else, you really, just good driving skill will get you pretty far. Just an opinion, Dick. K2RIW, K2QIQ.
2EO, Dick.
2MU.
Rich recognized and Bernie recognized in that order. I've been driving automobiles for, let me think, going on 60 years. I can easily say, hey, I've had very few fender benders in 60 years. I could easily, foolishly, puff my chest out and say, I'm an expert driver. I could say those words. They'd be hollow words. In reality, every 3 years, my wife and I take a defensive driving course. My motivation is two motivations. On the top of the list, I'll admit it, I get 10 or 15%, I forget what the number is, decrease in my automobile insurance with Amica if I can prove that every 3 years I take the course. So I save money. Second of all, even though I think I'm an expert with almost 60 years of driving experience and very few fender benders, every time I take that course, yeah, it does take me some hours. I do learn something each time that I didn't know, and I didn't expect to learn that. And they learn something from me each one of those times. Let me drop. Having spent quite a bit of time at Rome Air Development Center near Utica, New York, where I'm in a rural area, mountainous rural area, that frequently gets icy roads, all of us in the metro area do not know one thing, and the driver, defensive driving course, doesn't know to add this factor. If you're about to drive down a long, descending, icy road, you take every one of your friends and ask them, what's the right way to do it? Put the car in drive, put it in low, or put it in neutral. You're about to drive down a long, icy road. The people in a rural area know the answer is neutral. You do not want the engine drag on those front wheels or rear wheels, whichever your car is. You don't want engine drag on those wheels because pumping the brakes would not be enough. If every one of those wheels on the vehicle is not turning at the exact same rate that the road is moving under you, if the wheel is not doing that, you have no steering, and you will slide off to one side into the ditch and end up with your vehicle upside down. You will put the vehicle in neutral when you're going down a long, icy road to save your life. If it's a dry, long, downhill road, you put it in drive or low to save your brakes. But on icy road, neutral is the answer. Nobody gives that answer. They learned something from me in the taking of that course. So none of us are expert enough. There's always something else to be learned to give proper situation awareness. We all should put 3 seconds between us and the vehicle in front of us. Let me drop.
I have a comment, Dick.
Choose some particular object, like a line in the road or whatever, that the vehicle in front of you is passing. Count the number of seconds before you cross that line. There should be 3 seconds. No matter what speed you're moving, there should be 3 seconds. I will admit, with that amount of space on the Lower Elm Expressway, you're going to continuously have a certain number of people diving in that space in front of you. And yes, if you're foolish enough, you can get angry and start screaming at them for doing that. But if you manage to keep 3 seconds of space between you and the vehicle in front of you, a high percentage of the rear end collisions will not take place. You've now got that buffer of driving distance, reaction time to save you and the vehicle you're about to strike. Very few of us do that. But if you're smart enough to do that, and if you're smart enough not to get angry when you know people are going to drive in front of you, it is definitely worth the effort. Rich and Glenn in that order. N2EO, K2LIW in the TechNet. Go ahead, Rich.
Okay, Dick, N2EO. You know, I have on my car, it's called a tinted window exemption permit. Very, very hard to get. It allows me to have dark tint for medical reasons. I got it back in 1995. The person who got it for me was a sergeant from the 109 precinct, along with a city councilman who was very helpful. You can't even get that permit today after 9/11. That's what I'm told. But an interesting thing, a police officer who pulled me over once because I had a mobile rig, I had the dark window tint, he said to me, what's a good idea, probably with the tint or without the tint, he said, if it looks like a police officer is going to pull you over, he said, open your windows on the car because they don't know what you've got behind that glass, if anything. And he said it shows good faith to open your windows. Fantastic.
That does sound like a good suggestion, Rich. So in the process of him driving alongside and looking in, and you suspect he's worried about what is behind those dark windows, by you rolling down the window, he can now look at you and see that you're not a person that looks crazy. He's not obviously carrying a firearm. That the good faith it shows probably avoids any further encounter. Good suggestion. Glenn, KC2QIQ, K2LAW, go ahead, Glenn.
That's also Dick.
No, John recognized. Glenn first.
No, I think I've covered enough on this one so far, Dick, and I think it was a great discussion, though, overall, and a lot of good points brought out by everybody here. But maybe we should go into a different topic. K2QIQ.
Okay, John first, and then we'll go over to Bernie, who asked the original question. And it's, in my opinion, it's worth discussing because there's a lot of misunderstanding here, and there's something that we really should try to stop. KC2WGB, KQRW, go ahead, John.
KC2WGB. Dick, I believe it is still against the law to operate your car in neutral in New York. Freewheeling was never allowed here. They may have changed the law, but you really can't do that legally.
And each time I bring that to the attention of the people in the defensive driving course, they bring that, they tell me that. You're not legal, you're not allowed to be in neutral. And so now, if you're really about to descend a long, icy, downhill road, if you put it in neutral, there's a higher probability you'll save your life. And now you've got to decide, am I going to put myself at risk for a ticket or to save my life? I know which one I'm going to choose. On top of that, I think it's going to be very difficult for somebody following you in a law enforcement vehicle to be able to confirm that you were in neutral at that time. Because as soon as you get to the bottom of the hill, you're going to be back in drive. So maybe maybe that's not so much to worry about. Bernie, we're going to stop this one for now because we really should go on. However, it is a sufficiently universal subject that ham radio operators are being encountering, being subjected to, and therefore I'm awful glad you brought it to our attention. K2 Mike Uniform for a final comment. K2 RIW on SecNav.
Okay, K2MU. Okay, thank you, everybody. I really didn't intend to spend all the time. I know it's of interest to everybody, but really didn't expect it to go on that long. And I thank everybody for all the suggestions, which I've written down. All the different opinions and suggestions were all written down, and I will be... I want to see if I can get some legal representation, maybe another ham, because... What was I going to say before, just as a final transmission here? As far as, you know, 10%, I think we have to be aggressive about this, because it's not enough to put down the microphone when you see a cop. In my case, it was an unmarked car, and I had no idea that being stopped at a light, and this portable thing, you know, I would have put the radio down, but even that's not good enough, you know. I mean, you know, I remember the day, I'm sure all of us do, every time there's an earthquake or somewhere around the world, ham radio's on the news. Everybody knows that. And there should be a national exemption, and we should not be on the defensive. I mean, the very name of this club is Limark. You know, you take the mobile out of that. Every time you pass a cop, we shouldn't be, you know, that has to be changed. I think I'm going to be speak with the ARRL again this week because it's been several months. And I think we have to really be proactive about that, and I will do what I can to help the cause. And once again, I appreciate everybody's suggestions, and I think there was something else. Just, yeah, be safe out there. Let's hope, we don't have to worry about this in the future. That's all. And that's it. So back to you, Dick. K2RIW, K2NU.
Now, Bernie, you have apologized for us being on that subject a long time. That was my decision, not yours, not to worry. Neil, I hope we haven't put you to sleep with all this, if you're still there. KC2, Charlie, Mike, Quebec, K2RIW. Go ahead, Neil.
No, not asleep. I just have question envy, I think, at this point.
Go right ahead. Question envy. You're about to ask anything you want that has something remotely to do with ham radio indoor. Yeah, ham radio. Go right ahead, Neil.
What I wanted to ask you about was counterpoises for a NFED antenna. I have an NFED antenna, and I'm having some problems with it. It was advertised as not needing a counterpoise. However, I figured out what it's doing is using the coax shield as a counterpoise. Now, I've been able to find quite a bit of information about the counterpoise, everything but the physical layout of it. How do you, do I run the wire, bring it down the pole a little bit and run it parallel to the NFED, or do I run it down and actually ground it? How do you physically install the counterpoise?
I think I know where you're going here, Neil. If my radiator was a, well, go first step. Assuming I've got a true half-wave dipole in free space, and I'm feeding it with twin lead in a symmetric manner, in a thoroughly differential manner, at one instant of time, the right side is positive, the left side is negative, and the next half cycle the other way around. Because at one instant of time, right side is positive, left side is negative, there is a neutral plane between the two halves of that dipole. Believe me, you could put an infinite wide sheet of metal perpendicular to the dipole right down the center. You could put a sheet of metal there, nothing would change. It'd have the exact same efficiency, radiation pattern, gain, nothing would change. Once you accept that infinite sheet of metal at right angles to the dipole, you have the ability, if you want to throw away the left-hand side of the dipole and feed only the right-hand side with reference to the sheet of metal. The 70 ohm impedance goes down to one-half, 35 ohms, and you do that. Take that dipole that I just described, rotate it 90 degrees, you and I call it a quarter-wave ground plane. We call it the normal antenna you put in your backyard. And because that ground plane, that counterpoise in that case, is trying to act like an infinite sheet of metal, if you want the highest possible efficiency, let me drop. You want the highest possible efficiency out of the antenna. You're going to lay down maybe 32 individual wires of the ground plane system, the counterpoise system, because you don't want any of the RF energy to look in between those individual wires and see dirt, because the dirt at a grazing angle out there at a long distance, and you're talking about the angle of elevation, the dirt is primarily a mirror and it's a reflector. But in the near field, when that quarter wave radiator is within a few feet of that soil is a volumetric resistive material. You pour any substantial amount of RF energy into the soil, you're heating up the worms, you're converting your beautiful RF valuable energy into heat, and it's lost forever. And so you have to lay down a whole lot of wires so that the RF energy does not have the ability to look between the wires and see that dirt. That's what happens with a quarter wave antenna. Now, there's a beautiful way you can get around this. Let me drop the call. That quarter wave antenna against that counterpoise is feeding something like a 35 ohm impedance, 36 ohms. If you make the quarter wave resonator, the radiator, a half wave long, you're now feeding a half wave dipole, not from the center where it's 73 ohms, from the outer edge. The outer edge has something like 1500 ohms of resistive impedance. When you're feeding 1500 ohms, the disadvantage is you've got to put an L network, an inductor and a capacitor there to take your 50 ohms and step it up to the 1500 ohms of the antenna to feed it. Call it a voltage multiplier, call it an impedance matcher, call it whatever you like. A simple L network, one inductor and one capacitor, will do that job beautifully for you right at the feed point at ground. But now you're feeding an impedance of roughly 1500 or 2000 ohms as such. If you have nothing but a ground rod at that point, and the ground rod has an impedance to the earth of, let me pick a number, 100 ohms, but you're feeding 1500 ohms, percentage-wise, 95% of the voltage, power, whatever, is going into the antenna, and very little of it is going into the impedance of that rod. So when you feed one end of a half-wave dipole, because of its high impedance, you can get away with murder, and very little counterpoise is required, and the phase center of the antenna is a quarter-wave higher in the air. You're going to get a lower angle of radiation, higher efficiency, all kinds of good things happen, but there's a catch. Let me drop. If your long wire, in my example, the half-wave radiator, is not a half-wave, if it's now not the right length, if your long wire antenna is not a multiple of a half-wave long, you get the super high impedance, where you get a much lower resistive component of impedance. Now the quality of your ground plane starts coming back into play. And so are you feeding current back down? By the way, the current that you would feed back down the coax cable, if, for instance, you decided to put your half-wave dipole three-quarters of a wave up into the air, you got a tall enough tower where you can do this, you got a piece of coax cable going up there, and the center conductor goes to the L-network, to the outside end of this half-wave radiator, and yes, you're launching some current onto the outside of the shield of the coax, but because the coax is basically a 50-ohm source, and you're feeding a 1,500-ohm or 2,000-ohm impedance of the half-wave radiator, that current on the outside of the coax is an extremely small one, and how you ground it almost doesn't matter. Maybe in that case, grounding it to the tower would help, but it's not necessarily required. And a little bit of energy flowing down the outside of the coax is not necessarily bad. If the resonator radiator is exactly a half wave or a multiple of it, you can get away with murder. But if it's not a half wave, the resistive component is, you're going to correct the reactive component to create the resonance in order for you to radiate, but if the resistive component comes down, if you plot resistive component versus length, and you can see that in the so-called Brown and Woodward curve. The Brown and Woodward curve tells you exactly what impedance you're going to get for any length of antenna of any diameter. Brown and Woodward curve, you can find it in the website of K2RIW that's on the bottom end of the A1MBA website. You go to, let me drop. You go to Whiskey Alpha 1, MikeBravoAlpha.org. Tom Williams' microwave website. At the bottom of it, you'll see some diode feeding and Yagi feeding information by K2RIW. In that article, you will find the Brown and Woodward curve. square foot, any diameter of wire of any length. One curve will tell you what is the resistive component, the other curve will tell you what is the reactive component. If you're smart enough to choose half wavelength and multiples of it, where the resistive component is very high, you can get away with murder. If the resistive component is not high, then the quality of your ground plane and the location of your ground plane, your counterpoise, will count. So, when you're feeding an end fire, a long wire antenna, in this particular case, where you're worried about the quality of the counterpoise, the length of the wire is important. And in some cases, a rather minor change of the length of the wire, bringing it into one of the multiples or half wavelengths of resonance, can give you a huge advantage. Maybe that helps a little bit, Emil. K2, Charlie Mike Quebec, K2 LAW in the SECNET.
So what you're saying is if I have the wire the right length, having it feed down through the coaxial to the to the lightning arrestor, and then grounding through the lightning arrestor should have the same effect as any other counterpoise would. Over.
What you said, Neil, is very close to correct. It's not exact, but very close. The magic of recognizing the fact that the dipole doesn't have to be fed in the center, even though 99% of us all do it that way. That's the diagram we've seen in the book when we were learning electronics. We think at first that's the only way to feed a dipole from the center, 73 ohm impedance. If you're smart enough, there's nothing magic about the center. If the radiator is a half wavelength long or multiple, and you feed it from the outer end where you see this extremely high impedance, you can get away with murder, and your lightning arrestor grounding rod is more than good enough. You'd be amazed how many people have on the 20th floor of an apartment, going out to the balcony of their apartment, made the radiator a half wavelength long electronically. Sometimes it was held rewound, but electronically it was a half wavelength long. And that's, say, for instance, 20 meters. They fed it from the outer edge against the railing, the guardrail of the balcony, and it worked like a charm. And as a ground plane counterpoise system, at first you'd say, gee, that's terrible. There's very little metal there. It's 200 feet in the air on the 20th floor of this apartment building. There's no local ground anywhere. You talk to the guy who has done that. A half wavelength electronic radiator, whether it's got loading coils, chelically wound, top head capacitors, whatever. It's electronically half-wave, and the counterpoise is nothing but that little bit of a metal railing sitting on top of the concrete wall of his balcony, and that worked like a charm. So the bottom line is, make that radiator half-wave or a multiple, and you can get away with murder, and very little ground plane radial, very little counterpoise requirement is there. And it's not going to give you 100
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
That very skimpy ground plane system is not going to give you 100% efficiency, but it's going to be close enough to it that you'll be very happy with the results. At least the people who have done it have all come back with smiles on their face, if you know what I mean, Neil. KC2, Charlie Mike Quebec, K2LAW in the TechNet.
Thank you, Dick. Do you have time for one more question? I know it's late. I don't know how many other people you have waiting.
Fire away, Neil.
I'm also concerned with this setup that I have with coupling. I know I have some coupling problems now that I can take care of fairly easily, but my plan is to have, on a non-conductive pole, the feed end of the end fed sitting a couple feet below a VHF ground plane antenna. Any way to tell if that's actually going to create some coupling problems for me?
Because the frequency separation between VHF and an HF antenna is so wide, you've got a lot going for you. A few feet below is the feed point for your long wire or end fed ZEP or whatever you call it, and the VHF is above it. I think the coupling is going to be extremely small for a whole bunch of reasons. One, the VHF radio has in its front end a tuned circuit that passes VHF frequencies and it strongly rejects HF frequencies. And if your transmitter on HF is following the usual FCC rules, where the higher harmonics of that